Hi, folks. Welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament Lectionary Podcast for Friends of the Hebrew Bible Everywhere. And we are joining you on this August 24th of 2024, the year of our Lord, for a party episode. I'm Dr. Rosie Canethel, Assistant Professor of Bible at Wake Forest University.
Well, since we're introducing each other, he's Paul Asa at Yale University.
And she is Rachel, Reverend Dr. Rachel Wren, Professor of Bible at Capital University.
And then there's this guy.
That leaves me.
Then there's him. Sorry.
Dr. Tim McNinch at Christian Theological Seminary.
Awesome.
So here we are, and we have multiple texts available to us. One of them is from the first reading, that is from 1 Kings chapter 8. And we have, what is this? In parentheses, we have verse 1, verse 6, verses 10 and 11, and then also verses 22 to 30 and 41 to 43.
It's epic. It's an epic chop-chop.
Thank you, lectionary folks.
But, I mean, in essence, this is Solomon's dedication of the temple in Jerusalem, right? So the parenthetical part is a little bit of context for what's happening. And then the unparenthetical sections are parts of Solomon's, like, prayer of dedication, if I remember right.
Yep.
Yeah, this is a really pivotal moment in Israelite history, isn't it?
It is. And we'll get to it eventually, right? So there's other texts that we have to consider for the week, such as?
Yeah, I mean, there's a gorgeous psalm, Psalm 48, one of my favorites.
84, right?
And, yeah, 84, you know, whichever you want to do. No, it is 84.
Chiasms.
Yeah. I'm just lost in chiasms. No, it is Psalm 84.
And then we've got Ephesians 6, verses 10 through 20 for the epistle. And, of course, ongoing, the Bread of Eternal Life discourse from John chapter 6, 56 through 69, the closing portion of that. So, a variety of texts to talk about today.
Yeah. And preachers, if you're getting sick of the Bread of Life discourse, which goes on and on and on, you could come join us in the first reading.
It's like when the Israelites got tired of the manna in the wilderness.
That's right. That's
right. Enough of this bread.
Give us something else to eat.
Give us meat.
Come with the flesh pots. Come with the flesh pots.
There we go.
So why don't we take a few minutes here to talk about 1 Kings 8. And, you know, Paul, I think you said that you've thought about this a bit in its context. Tell us a little bit about what's happening here and some of your thoughts on it.
Yeah. Definitely, canonically, this is the period of the monarch. David is no more on the scene. Solomon is in charge. David could not build the temple, as we all know. Solomon, apparently at this point, built it. And this is a ceremony dedicating or consecrating the freshly built temple. But there's also like a lot of things about the Ark of the Covenant and the presence of God, and the movement of the Ark of the Covenant from its nomadic sort of state into a state of permanence, where it is finding new home and new dwelling within the temple, right? And that is followed by a series of prayers that essentially petitions God to be gracious and to hear and listen and be kind to everybody who prays or does something within the new temple that has been built, essentially asking for a blessing upon the sacred space. I guess, you know, like a lot of things can be said about the passage truly. But I kept thinking more about, you know, things like the movement of the presence of God into a state of permanence, and thinking about the presence of God in nomadic terms, like, you know, that the presence of God did not have a permanent location, but now it does.
So, that was a part that I hadn't really considered that much, but I know that this concept of movement and nomadic versus settled is something that's been a part of your study, Paul. Why do you think that's significant here? What layer of meaning does this give to the text for you?
I mean, there's, you know, a lot of discussion also towards the end about, like, you know, exilic conditions. and foreigners and foreigners finding a home in the temple, especially like foreign converts or foreign inquirers who are impressed or struck by the works of God or the name of God, and they coming into the temple to seek the face of God and the blessing that they should acquire from there. There's a lot of resonance with, you know, other movements in the Bible, and especially experiences of exiles and travelers and people who journey from one place to the other in search of something. And I think the thinking of God's presence as journeying to look for a permanent sort of place, whether permanence is good or not, like, you know, it sort of has a way of giving solace to people who are in a condition like that, that God too experienced the condition that I would consider and think of as exilic or like a sojourner, you know.
There's a section there starting in verse 46 or so that talks about the people being in exile and praying towards this place.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's, I've sort of wondered, like, if they're in exile and the temple's destroyed and all of that, like, what difference does any of this make?
Yeah.
But it seems like there is a kind of, like, intentional nostalgia in a way about the holiness of this site.
Yep.
And that even in a state of exile for the people, that they can turn their attention towards this space, this place, and that there's like spiritual effectiveness in even that dislocated scenario. Yeah. Does that resonate with you all?
I think for me, the thing that struck me is that this is not just about the exilic people, but about the diaspora.
Right.
So there's a recognition here that it speaks both to the period of the exile and then also way beyond, in that there is an orientation of the people toward a place, and that by that they are connected. So, you know, you see this in Daniel too, this sort of praying toward Jerusalem. And that by that they are connected no matter where they are. And so to me, what Paul's kind of talking about too, this migratory God is also, you know, a recognition of the people in their own movement, and that their movement does not remove them from the presence of God, but opens up new opportunities for them to draw upon the presence of God that rests in Jerusalem, but dwells within them. So, you know, this is even toward the bread of heaven discourse, the sense that that we all eat from the same table, can be dispersed and still be one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Gorgeous.
A little sort of structural thing that's kind of interesting. The passage in 1 Kings kind of it moves outward. So it starts out talking about the focused presence of God in the temple itself, and then about prayers and sacrifices that are offered in that space. But then as the prayer moves out, it talks more about people praying towards the temple and having their prayers heard. And then it talks about people praying towards Jerusalem from further afield, and still their prayers are heard and answered. And then finally, it's just, if they pray just towards the land at all, then God will hear and answer their prayers. So there is this sort of like outward spread of God's accessible presence with the people, wherever they might be.
And if we're thinking about this as a pivotal text, you know, as Solomon's dedication, that those last verses in this reading, which include the foreigner, specifically making this a house for all people,
exactly,
you know, that to me is quite significant to hear that in the initial prayer. This is not just about this nation establishing its temple toward its God, but that it is a resource for all people, right? As we talk about Solomon and wisdom being something that all nations might desire and want to have a part of, Solomon seems to acknowledge that in this prayer. And if I could also just say a little bit about prayer here, like we have not seen a lot of kings doing public prayer this way. And in the passage for the week before, we just had heard Solomon praying aloud for a wise and discerning heart, a listening heart, an attentive heart. And so as we look at this passage in 1 Kings chapter 8, that seems to be another kind of walking forward of this image of Solomon in this public prayer that also feels very personal. He has a relationship with this God And so as we think as congregations about what prayer looks like and feels like, this is a model in some ways of the ideal king being able to speak from a personal relationship with God, but on behalf of the people. So they also are included in this prayer. That's and right. We see this carried forward in the way that mm-hmm. Ezra prays aloud too. So, you know, this image of the king praying on behalf of the people in a sacred space.
It's kind of a priestly role, right?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful thing to point out. Like as pastors are standing before the people, you are also, you know, kind of walking forward a model that's been set here in the Old Testament as you pray for your people.
Yep.
Yeah, gorgeous idea.
The figure of Solomon as playing a priestly role is very important also for understanding like the kinds of things that he prays about, you know, mm-hmm. moving forward in, I think, 26 there about. Like in 22, the text says he spread out his hand towards heaven and then said words, like he prayed, which is a uh-huh. very like good gesture, like an embodied prayer gesture or posture, right? And then he begins to pray for all these kinds of things, like, you know, that people's prayers will be answered, that people receive forgiveness, that, you know, in times of famine, God will send rain and the foreigner will find home, like all these really interesting and powerful things and words that a king would say over a sacred space as the temple of God. Really mm-hmm. interesting.
As we're kind of talking about Solomon as a model, I think it's important to note that there is a slight corrective that the text does to Solomon, mm-hmm. which we don't get in our lectionary text today, but it is very interesting. It's based around the Hebrew word kadosh, you know, to be holy, and then the hifil, it's to make holy, which, you know, in bad English is to holify, and in good English is to consecrate. So, you know, this is what's going on in this text, is that a holy space is being consecrated.
Holified.
It's being holified, that's right. And we have rituals to do that today, too. Sometimes the place is considered holy prior to the ritual. Sometimes it's the ritual itself that actually creates the sacredness of the space. And then sometimes it's a third thing altogether. And what we have in this text is two different interpretations about how this space was made holy. Mm-hmm. So Solomon has this huge, long prayer. And then in verse 64, it says, the same day the king consecrated the middle of the court that was in front of the house of the Lord. So that the king's ritual, the king's prayer, is actually doing something to holify, to consecrate at least a part of the temple. But in 1 Kings 9:3, God shows up to Solomon and has a bit of a rejoinder to the prayer. Mm-hmm. So in this text, it says, the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your plea, which you made before me. I have consecrated this house that you have built and put my name there forever. Mm-hmm. So the text wants to make very clear that, yes, Solomon did all the proper ritual. He had the great gestures. He had a perfect prayer. But that the actual consecration of the space, the holifying, was done by the Holy One. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really helpful, not just reminder, but again, just sort of posture for us to inhabit for a couple of different reasons. Hubris is a real thing in, I think, the church, and it's sort of a backwards hubris, like who can be the most suffering servant sometimes, who can be the hardest working. But it's important, this text reminds us that the work that is done is God and God's alone, that in some ways we are called to it, but that the actual enacting of bringing people to God or of holifying spaces or people really is God's. And so then we get to rest on God's agency and power in those scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, chapter 9 there goes on to, it's just if. Right. Like for Solomon's part, like you can be a part of this if you abide by the ways that God is laying out. So again, exactly what you were saying, Rachel. You know, one other thing I wanted to bring up about this text, a theme that comes up over and over in it is this concept of the name of God.
Yeah.
That this is a dwelling mm-hmm. for God, but specifically for the name of God.
You can go Carmen Imes on us?
We could.
I love that book.
Yeah. A good book plug here from our friend, Dr. Carmen Imes. Bearing God's Name from IVP. Really, really helpful.
Ends it like you said, sorry, if I can just put one thing, like it upends the way we think about God's name, and especially taking God's name in vain in a really helpful way. Yeah. Like that concept has been needed to be disrupted for a long time.
Right.
And she does that well. So yeah, fully agree, Tim.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the places in scripture where the name of God kind of comes to the front and center in this dedication here. And there's a couple streams of scholarly interpretation around this. One of them says that by talking about the name of God, it's a kind of like hesitation about God's actual presence here. It's not that God was going to dwell in the temple, but just sort of God's name was there as a kind of, you know, not wanting to put God in a box. And you know, there are a few verses in this that...
nobody puts Adonai in a corner.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Verse 27.
Yep.
Will God indeed dwell on the earth? Even heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you, much less this house that I've built.
Yeah.
And partly what we probably have here is a bit of editorial work through the generations in the text, where there's one stream that's very just celebrating that finally God's going to live in this spot. And another stream that says, well, let's not go so far as to say that. Let's temper that a little bit. So you have a little bit of that sort of thing, which is very common in the biblical text in general. So it's nothing super controversial. It's just there's a conversation happening among the scribes who transmitted these texts to us about what it means for God's presence to be somewhere.
Yeah.
And one of the ways they talk about it is with the sense of the name of God being somewhere.
Yeah.
But there's another stream of scholarship that says, you know, it's not that they're trying to temper that, but they're actually kind of doubling down on it by saying that God's name is dwelling in this place. That's a way of saying that God was physically present in this space. Mm-hmm. And that comes from kind of a comparative religions thing. There's, you know, other places around, you know, Israel's neighbors had similar language about their monuments and temples, that the name of their God dwelled there. And it got me reflecting a little bit. Maybe, Rosie, I don't know if you've had this ritual yet, but when you move to a new place, often there's a point where you find the mailbox and you take a sticker or something and you put your name on that place saying, this is now where I live. This is the place where my name dwells.
That's right.
And for me, at least, you know, when I do that at the mailbox, that's when it feels sort of official. Or maybe, you know, on a lease, you're signing your name on a lease, or on a mortgage, like 27,000 times on a mortgage. But there's a sense that, you know, when we put our name somewhere, that we're claiming it as, this is the space where I now live in some sort of permanent state.
That's right.
And so the placing of God's name on this temple is a way of saying that the God who's everywhere and who has traveled with the people here and there has chosen this place as home base. And from now on, you know, even if the people are dispersed around the world, they can, you know, turn their attention towards God's home, and God will hear their prayers. So there's something kind of profound in that kind of a theology too, which I'd sort of reflect through to our, you know, contemporary Christian sort of understandings of what it means to be a people of God who bear God's name.
Yeah.
And this isn't one of the lectionary texts, but I always think of, I think it's 1 Peter, where the apostle talks about the church being a temple of God's spirit, of living stones that are built together.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
Where God dwells. Mm-hmm. And so it just raises all sorts of questions for me of what does it mean to bear God's name, to use Carmen Himes's title there, to be a people where God has put the sticker on us as this is where I dwell. That I think that has big implications for what it means to be a people of God. And I think there's probably some, you know, preaching real estate to cover there too.
Well, and you know, I mean, we joked at the beginning about if you're tired of the bread of life text, you know, come to here. But there are some beautiful, I think, you know, if you wanted to bring in the John text, this would be a really nice way to do it. You know, again, over and over again, these Hebrew Bible texts were picked to highlight something about the gospel text. So when you spend the time dwelling in them as we have, you know, what does it mean to be a living stone? Well, it means that you eat the living body and blood of Christ. And that's what allows that, you know, act allows you to continue to persist as a living stone of the temple. So I think there's some fun ways to bring in that gospel text at this point if you wanted to.
If the stones are alive, you have to feed them?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Well, and even, you know, not to jump to the psalm, but God is called a God of life, you know, El Chai in that psalm. So there's these themes of life and what is necessary for living somewhere, eating and, you know, breathing and having a relationship with the people around you are all throughout these texts.
We could talk about Psalm 84 a little bit. It's a temple psalm, right?
Yeah, it's so pretty. It's just so good.
That's all we want to say. It's pretty.
It really is. I mean, it's just one of my favorite psalms of all time, like in terms of poetry, in terms of faith promises, in terms of imagery. It just, you know, and it's been put to music. How lovely
exactly
is your dwelling place? You know, it's just gorgeous music that comes out of it. It's kind of fun. There's a couple little linguistic fun things and then some very not linguistic fun things. verse two, how lovely is your dwelling place? That's actually yedidot, which every other time it occurs is beloved. So this could also be translated as how beloved is your dwelling place. Of course, they share a root, lovely, beloved. But it's just, you know, it's not just an aesthetic. It's not just a beauty. There's this power of love and connection that is associated with the dwelling place of God here. So I think, you know, for preachers, you could really start to play with that a little bit about what does it mean for God's dwelling to be beloved, especially if you go back to the living stones thing. If you are God's dwelling place, how beloved are you, know, to in God's eyes even? And that's playing with the text a little bit. But, you know, as preachers, you're allowed to do that. So that's the fun thing. The not fun thing is that verse six, which is one of my all-time favorite verses in the whole Bible, is just completely like all over the place. There are text critical notes up the wazoo.
Every
on
word.
That one. Oh my gosh, just about. So I was like going to talk about it and I was like, no. The one thing I will say is it's got this really pretty, verse six. So if you go back one more verse, it kind of sets up verse six. Happy are those whose strength is in you, in whose heart are the highways to Zion. As they go through the valley of Baca, they make it a place of springs. Mm. The early rain also covers it with pools. They go from strength to strength. Mm. I have loved that section since I discovered it when I was a camp counselor at Flathead Luther Bible Camp in Montana. I just remember, I vividly remember reading it and being like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. Because it's this concept of, you know, the valley of Baca, we don't really know what's going on there. It could be a corrupted Hebrew word that was actually meant to be ending with a kind of an H sound, a hey, instead of an olive.
Tears, crying.
And so it would be weeping.
Tears, crying.
Yeah, as you go through a valley of weeping. But it can also be kind of a, there's a couple other places that sort of talk about it as more like a deserty place. But either way, if it's a valley of weeping resonating with Psalm 23, or if it's a desert place, it makes sense here. You know, as you go through this valley of pain and suffering, it becomes a valley of abundance. And then I just love this idea in the next verse. I mean, I'm tipping all the way into preaching right now, but in verse seven, they go from strength to strength. You know, it's not this idea that life is always perfect. It's that every time you take a step, that step is supported. Yep. That step is, you know, on firm foundation. That step is strong. And so you can keep taking those steps with this image of the highway being in your heart. You can keep taking those steps even as you're going through a valley of weeping or a valley of dry bones.
Yeah.
So it's just, I mean, like, oh my gosh, just preach it.
That is gorgeous. Yeah.
Yeah, I love this psalm. Hmm.
Yeah, you didn't even talk about a day in your courts is better than a thousand elsewhere, right?
The songs. Yeah, better is one day in your courts. Well, and the thing that I love about this psalm too is it harkens back to Psalm 1 a couple of times, especially like in verse 12. It has the Asherei, happy is the one, theme. And it's really, it's just lifting up this idea, which the psalms goes for over and over again, that happiness wells up for those who are planted firmly, whose roots are reaching into the abundant well of God. That's where happiness comes from. And I just think in a world that like tries to draw us into an economy of prestige, an economy of competition, an economy of never enoughness, there's this promise from the Psalms, which is radical and which we are so hungering for, that no, if you stay rooted here and you allow God to root you firmly here, that's where happiness dwells up.
Mm. Amazing.
Preachers, you hope you're paying attention.
I love this.
Forget all that First Kings 8.
Seriously, go to the second reading.
I love the Psalms.
I probably also think that the a connection between finding a home, like, you know, as in First Kings 8, you know, finding a home for God, right? And then the idea of the sparrow finding a home and the swallow finding a nest for herself and where she may lay her young ones in 84 verse 3. It's like fascinating, like really great point of connection here between the two passages. Yeah.
That's a great insight, Paul, because the dwelling place here is for the worshiper as well. Like, if this is God's home, if this is where God dwells, I want to, can I sublease? Yeah. Can I have a room there?
Yeah.
And, you know, the one who gets to dwell there is the happy one. Yeah.
It is the happy one.
There's two thoughts that came to my mind because I was playing with the sparrow a little bit too. And of course, you know, Old Testament roots for New Testament fruits. What does Jesus talk about in Matthew? God's eye is on the sparrow. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a beautiful kind of connecting point there. I do wonder if there's some irony because birds were sacrificed on the altars and that's where the bird is said to find a home. So like, is there some dark humor here or what's exactly going on? Preachers, you don't maybe have to go there, but that's where my mind went.
Well, friends, we've had some really great conversation here. Did any of you have any kinds of preaching pitfalls that you'd want to bring up with these texts, either the First Kings 8 or the Psalm 84, or any particular ways that, besides what we've already said about getting into a sermon?
You know, there's this sort of, probably more in my tradition than other traditions, but there's this rhetoric of like referencing Solomon building a temple and, you know, consecrating this gigantic temple and referencing that as a way of, let us also like build God a temple. And within my, you know, Ghanaian context, like this passage has been referenced to support political conversations about building a national cathedral. And it's a very controversial conversation because it's like, you know, where are the resources coming from? And, you know, whose taxes is going to be used to build the temple. And all the political leaders keep saying is, look at the passage. Like, you know, the passage says we should build something for God and let's build something for God in honor of God's name. And, you know, to a good extent, like abused the actual relevance of the passage in making a political point, right, in front of people. So perhaps just like a caution for people to really pay attention to what they mean when they say, here's something in the text. Let's also go and do it. Right. Let's do some. Let's replicate what we see in the text. You know?
I'm glad you bring out the controversy there because there, even though this First Kings 8 is a kind of lofty celebratory passage, there is controversy embedded in here and it's worth, you know, attending to that. In sort of my circles with this, it's usually the opposite of that I hear. Mm. It's not that we should build something physical for God. Mm. It's the, God can't dwell in any temple, stupid Israelites. Why would they have ever thought that? God is everywhere. And there's a kind of like sneaky kind of supersessionism that comes into that interpretation of, you know, the Old Testament Israelites thought that they could put God in a building.
Yeah.
But, you know, God really is everywhere. Yeah. And here's a little hint of that in this prayer, which couldn't they have, you know, paid more attention to that and skipped the whole temple thing and all of that. So I guess what I would say as a kind of pitfall is that you don't want to flatten out this text to just say one thing about what the temple means or meant and one thing about how God dwells in the world.
Yeah.
That because this has been redacted over the generations and this text with multiple different perspectives all embedded in it at the same time. That's what we have. That's what's come to us. And so as we see, you know, one part of the text saying, oh, this is so great that God's name is dwelling here. And another part that says, but God can't dwell in a temple. And another place that says, oh, if you just come to this place and offer prayers, then God will hear you. And another one that says, well, you don't have to be here. You can be from other place and just look towards this area and God will hear your prayers. It's not that one of those is the, you know, authoritative right answer and the other is wrong.
Yeah.
It's that what we have is a conversation, a negotiation, an exploration of what this means.
Exactly.
And I always take that if I'm preaching on a text like that as an invitation to that kind of exploration ourselves. What does it mean? What is God's name about among us?
Yeah.
How do we negotiate? What does it mean for God to dwell among us as a people and in our worship? And what does it mean for us to have this space where we gather to worship when some of our folks are, you know, online viewing it through Facebook? What does that have? What does this text have to say about distance worshiping? You know, there's that sort of conversation that all comes up, and this opens up a conversation rather than closing it down, I think.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful connection to the gospel, the Eucharist, too. I mean, each of our denominations hold this in different ways, and yet there's a, you know, we're all connected by it, by this kind of essential act of worship together, but we all would probably have different descriptions for what's happening. Mm. So, I mean, it's just helpful to understand this is the richness of our traditions and the various voices that we continue to kind of figure out together. It's the dialogue of faith.
Yeah, that's a great point, Rosie. I've been spending a lot of time recently thinking about Presbyterian polity and theology and all of that. And I discovered along the way that the PCUSA, which I belong to, and the ELCA, which Rachel belongs to, we have sort of an agreement, a shared understanding of that when we share the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist, that counts for everybody. Even though we actually have somewhat different theological understandings, you know, as denominations about what actually is happening in that meal. And yet we both acknowledge that this is something that actually brings us together, even with our different understandings. It brings us together and unites us as people who belong to Christ. It's kind of a neat holding together of the tension.
That's which is really what a good feast does, you know, brings people together.
Yeah, over conversation and agreement and disagreement.
Even when the weirdos like Rachel are there.
That's right.
Everybody's
talking about the psalm.
She's just got one thing to talk about, so if you sit next to her, it's a real boring conversation.
This has been such a great conversation. I'm glad. It's so nice to see your faces after a summer where we've been doing some things on our own. It's nice to be back together for this party. I had some thoughts coming in, but I learned so much from talking to you all.
I know. Every time. Yeah. It's such a rich conversation.
Speaking about feasts and dialogue. This is pretty...
And bread, which is nice.
Eating together, reading together. Yeah.
Well, preachers, we hope you got some good tidbits, nuggets, morsels, if we're continuing with the bread theme out of this.
Crumbs.
If nothing else, at least crumbs.
A dry bread crust of a sermon.
Oh, gosh. Just a reminder, in case you forgot, this is First Reading Podcast, and we do have a website, firstreadingpodcast.com. We invite you to go to that for all of our back episodes, for any sort of merchandise you might like. First Reading is produced by me and by Paul and by Rosie and by Tim. And we are super grateful to everybody who supports us along the way by donating or by sharing the podcast. Until next time, folks, I'm Rachel Wren.
Paul Essa.
I'm Tim McNinch.
And Rosie Candiffel.
Bye.
Happy preaching.
Did I do an outro? It felt like the moment, but I don't.
That was perfect.
Was it good?
It's very good.
Yeah.
All right.
Well done.